When news broke of the spate of suicides at the U.S. torture center at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, the response of Bush administration officials provides, at a glance, insight into their long train of failure in the so-called war on terror. The U.S. government response to the successful suicides of three detainees was twofold. First, they killed themselves to embarrass the government. And second, their suicides are de facto acts of war. When I heard these responses, my mouth dropped open in sheer disbelief. That's because over these long years in prison and on death row, I've seen more than my share of suicides, as well as unsuccessful attempts. Invariably, these acts came from men who had nothing to live for and who had reached the end of their rope. For them, death was a release from pain and suffering. Moreover, as human rights lawyer Michael Ratner has shown, in his 2004 book, Guantanamo, What the World Should Know, there are demonstrably innocent men being held as so-called enemy combatants in Guantanamo. Ratner cites the March 2004 release of five British citizens who, upon arrival in England, were released almost immediately. Ratner noted, "You can be sure these five Britishers were not guilty of anything at all, or the British would have put them on trial." Ratner, noting that these men spent years under brutal detention, said the five British cases reflects on other ones. And this is not just about the loss of years of these people's lives, or about whatever brutalities they may have undergone while they were in custody. Think of what it says about everyone else who is in Guantanamo. The United States has released a few of the many hundreds of people there, but many of the detained prisoners in Guantanamo, like those Britishers, may be innocent of any crime whatsoever. There's another reason why it's doubtful that these men were the jihadis that the government claims they were. In Afghanistan, U.S. military forces dropped leaflets offering large sums of money for terrorists. Afghans pointed out people and took the money. The problem is they were motivated by money, not truth. So poor people, tribal enemies, farmers, taxi drivers, etc., got roped into the net. A military interrogator at Camp Delta estimates 20% of detainees in Guantanamo are innocent. 20%. Yet they languish in conditions that a British court has called a legal black hole. Given such conditions, beatings, humiliations, desecration of one's faith and personhood, abduction to a strange country, and secret imprisonment, without hope, is it strange for one to see suicide as an act of war or as simply suicide to free oneself from impossible conditions? The great psychologist Sigmund Freud once quipped, "Sometimes a cigar is just a cigar." Well, sometimes suicide is suicide. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Prison Pipeline. This is Ruth Kovach. I'm happy that you're all with us again tonight. I have a very special guest, Rick Johnson. I invited him to bring some of his own music, and the opening music was something that Rick selected. And we're going to get right into an interview with him. Rick, I want you to say hello, tell us what the music was, and let us know what this RAP organization is that you belong to.
The Recovery Association Project is a nonprofit organization that is dedicated to giving people a voice and a face for recovery-based issues. RAP also has a bunch of other things that we do there. We have some coaching. We have a resource center. We just had our grand opening and had a we have a recovery club, which we have dances on Friday and Saturday nights. It's actually a place for people to socialize and learn from each other on how to stay clean and sober one day at a time.
That's just great. Now, you didn't answer the question. I wanted to know what the music was because I wanted to encourage our listeners to let us know. You can send us a postcard here at the KBOO station, or you can send us an email or make a phone call, whatever's easiest for you. Let us know what music you have that's favorite that would be suitable for the Prison Pipeline. So what did you bring in today, Rick?
I brought in one of my favorite songs. It's a song that was originally done by Bob Dylan back in the 60s, and then Guns N' Roses did a remake of it and did really, really well with it. It's called Knocking on Heaven's Door.
Yeah, it was a very good choice. Okay, let's get started. I wanted to ask you to talk about the availability of alcohol and drugs in prison. I want to know if while you're there, is it available or not? And is there any rehab available? And you've told me a lot of things that I want you to tell our listeners. So just go for it.
Okay. Well, you know, in my adult life, I've spent 18 years of my life locked up in prison due to my drug and alcohol addiction. That's four different prison terms, so that means I had to go to through the court system four different times and be released four different times. The whole time that I was incarcerated, drugs and alcohol were readily available if you knew how to get them and knew who to talk to while you're in there. So, you know, when I was using while I was incarcerated, getting drugs was fairly easy for me. I just put myself in a position to know where they were at and to get my hands on them.
And the lifestyle sure didn't motivate you to give it up, did it?
Absolutely not. You know, here's the sad part about it. You know, if you take a person and you put him in prison and he has a drug and alcohol addiction, that addiction hasn't left him. And so the most natural thing for a drug addict to want to do is to medicate, including while they're in prison. Prisoners are very good at finding ways and means of getting drugs and alcohol. Making pruno is a very simple process. It takes about 72 hours.
Is there some bonding that goes on that prisoners help each other get their drugs and alcohol?
Absolutely. To put it bluntly, prisoners are organized in there. That, you know, they have all day and all night to sit around and organize and to devise plans and find ways of getting what they want.
Well, I guess when you're incarcerated, you don't have the same values that we on the outside have. You don't have the same joys. You don't have the same pleasures. And probably it would be easy to understand that the highlight of the day would be your fix. And how much is the are the guards involved in helping you get this?
Well, in 1986, when I was in the Oregon State Penitentiary, there was a number of correctional officers that were, told on. And there was an investigation, and there was correctional officers that were arrested and convicted for trafficking narcotics into the Oregon State Penitentiary.
That was the Oregon State Penitentiary?
Yeah.
What other places were you incarcerated?
In the state of Oregon, I've been in Columbia River. I've been at the farm down in Salem. I've been at OSP and OSCI.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure each is different, and yet they all have a certain sameness, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, the mindset, I mean, in any prison situation that I've ever been in, and I've been in prisons in the state of California, Oregon, and the state of Washington, and the mindset is pretty much the same as far as, the prisoners is concerned. I mean, everyone's goal is basically tobacco, drugs and alcohol. Some prisoners, don't get me wrong, some prisoners get locked up and they don't participate in trying to get the narcotics. But if it's available to them, they will.
Well, you seem like a nice guy. Were you a nice guy during those years?
Absolutely not.
Absolutely not. Imagine that. Tell me, what was the transition from being a hard addict to rehabilitated? Did that begin in prison or what?
Well, the last time that I was arrested, I was arrested for 24 counts of identity theft. There was actually 250 victims, and they only charged me with 25 counts. Consequently, what ended up happening, which I had no idea, was I was the first person in the state of Oregon to be convicted of the crime of identity theft. And this was the first time also in my life that I actually had a crime partner. And so I had a woman that was helping me to do the crimes that I was doing, and she ended up getting arrested too. And that weighed real heavily on my heart. And there was a brief moment in my life where I actually tried, to not use drugs and alcohol and try to attend some recovery groups.
Well,
and stuff
all you
like
had to
that.
Do was quit. What do you mean you tried not to?
Well, it's like trying to tell a diabetic that look, you're not going to have an insulin reaction this today. You know, it's a disease that if it isn't, treated, will continue to progress until, either jail, institutions, or death, happens.
Well, those of us who know what you're talking about know what you're talking about. And those of us who don't know, I hope they never know.
Absolutely.
So how did you get a little rehab program going?
Well, here's the bottom line. In the state of Oregon, we have 15,000 state prisoners in our system. 96% of them or so will eventually be released. In the state of Oregon, there are 375 treatment beds available to 3,000 inmates that are going to be released in the next 365 days.
Say those numbers again. That's terrible.
There are 375 treatment beds available to the 3,000 state prisoners that are going to be released this year.
Wow.
And 92% or 93%, I think, was the last figure, need to be in treatment and to transition from prison back out into society.
So what percentage of that 3,000 do you think should be in a bed?
94 to 95% of them.
Really?
I mean, why else would somebody go to prison if they didn't have a drug and alcohol problem? I mean, there are certain cases where people do things that they shouldn't, but in most cases, drugs or alcohol are involved in the upper 90%.
Well, if they don't go to prison because of their involvement with drugs and alcohol, after they come in, do they get hooked and become addicted?
No, I wouldn't necessarily say that was true. If drugs and alcohol weren't the cause of somebody going to prison, in a normal case, I don't think that they would all of a sudden become addicted while they're right. It could happen, but I'm not,
So all these laws about tough on crime and sentencing rules that try to get people who have committed these terrible crimes into the prison, they're really helping the prison population grow and thrive. They want more prisoners so they can have more prisons. And actually, Amy Goodman did a 15-minute segment in Democracy Now! Today. And 2 weeks from tonight, I want to play that segment and give a report on the prisons and some of these numbers. And all you're telling me is that she was right on and knew what it was. So you finally, because they had like everyone in your whole, on the whole floor that you were on, got to have rehab program or?
No, absolutely not. You know, what I had to do personally was make a decision to try to find some help for my problem, and I had a moment of clarity while I was incarcerated, and I attended a recovery meeting while I was in there, and talked to some people from the street, and they recommended that I might try to see if I could get into treatment.
You said something kind of sweet there. You said, for my problem, as if you think that addiction is your problem, and there are so many folks out there, not just people who are addicted, but observers, especially mothers, that they think it's the system's problem, it's society problem. Well, maybe the system created a situation that your solution to the system was to develop the problem of addiction. But once it's there, once it's in your body, once it's in your soul, once it's in your mindset, it's your problem, and no one can get you out of it but you. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. You have to make a decision. At some point, there can be some intervention done. And some people say that jail is intervention. And I'm here to tell you, when I was 19 years old, I was convicted of 21 counts of burglary. I'm not bragging about this. I was actually only caught for one, and they said, well, we want to clear the books. And I ended up, we're not going to charge you with nothing. We're just going to, don't want anybody else to get arrested for something you did. And
so you confessed to
absolutely,
all
and they ended up charging me with them. And at the age of 19 years old, I was sentenced to 6 years and 8 months in the California Department of Corrections. When I was released from prison after doing 4 years, 7 months, and 27 days, I was released, and 4 months later, I was arrested again for the exact same thing that put me into prison for that first 4 years and 7 months and 27 days. So the bottom line is this. Prison is not the answer. Unless there is some rehabilitation, some treatment, and some transition coming from prison into, say, like an Oxford house or into some kind of recovery-based situation where the prisoner isn't coming from that negative, hateful environment back to the same environment that they came from, because it's like running into a wall. If something doesn't change, if you don't try to do something different, you're going to get the same result every single time. And prison isn't going to scare anybody. Prison never scared me.
Well,
it was comfortable
prison,
to me.
Prison Pipeline is a show that used to be hosted by Ann Rose Pierce, and we who have listened to it for years have always loved her. And one of the things she had as a project was a website and a project called After 17 Years. And the reason she called it After 17 Years was her husband, when he was still her sweetheart, and later they got married and so on, He was addicted and had been in and out of the system for 17 years. And his parole officer and Ann were talking one day, and she was saying, can't you give him this break, or can't you give me this information, and so on. And he said to her, well, if after 17 years he's still an addict, you might as well give up on him. And that made her very angry, because she said to herself, if after 17 years the system has not provided him with a rehabilitation plan or program or assistance of some sort, you know, it just made her angry, so she called her project after 17 years. So when I first met you, I heard you speaking at the Multnomah County hearings about budget cuts, and you were explaining why RAP needed to keep the money they were getting and get more, if anything, certainly not less. And you said, and I was in for 18 years, and now I'm clean. And I thought, well, maybe if her partner had had one more year, he might have got through to it. But as a matter of fact, he died of AIDS, chained to his bed, even though he was on intravenous and all sorts of tubes in him. They felt it was necessary to keep chains on his legs and his arms and a guard at his place. So there are a lot of sad stories out there, and the sad stories are what get me interested and enthusiastic about advocating for prison reform. But the good stories like yours of someone who has made something of their life, you're a student now, isn't that right?
Absolutely.
And you do some teaching, and you do some counseling at RAP. Well, supposing the prison system had given you a little rehab and you had come out of prison the first day and you were clean, how long would it take you to get more drugs and be right back in the habit? And why didn't you do that?
This time. You know, I really can't tell you what exactly happened. I just felt so much guilt for bringing another human being to prison when the only thing this human being wanted to do was to get a job and for us to, because I met her when she was in treatment in California. And so next thing you know, we're in prison, and I felt a tremendous amount of guilt, so much guilt that it was just unbearable. And I decided that, you know, I needed to try to do something, you know, to change my life, because look what I've done. You know, and I'm going to tell you, here's the bottom line. I was extremely lucky to get into treatment while I was incarcerated. And if I wouldn't have been persistent and been extremely, you know, vocal about, look, I want help, I want treatment, you know, I want to do something different than I've, you know.
Would you say you demanded the treatment?
I did demand it.
And you know, I think you gave me a number. You were one of how many that...
One of 375 people in the state of Oregon that was able to get a treatment bed during that 8-month period.
375 people wanted it, and you got it. Well, there's some luck there.
Yeah. But you want to hear the sad part about it? Well, you were just talking about some earlier, but in 1999, my mother and the rest of my family had said to each other that I was hopelessly addicted and institutionalized, and that I would spend the rest of my life either dead or locked up in prison. And through getting clean and sober, and through the recovery process, and through all the things that I've been able to do, you know, my mom now has a son back, and I'm the strength of my family today.
So your mother's still with you, and she has seen this change?
Absolutely.
And does she just glow every time she sees you?
She does.
And yeah. Tell me about the RAP program. What did they offer you that made it possible? How long have you been clean and sober?
I've been clean and sober 6 years and about 2 months.
6 years. Oh, that's great. It looks like you're over the edge, but... You never say never, right?
No, it's a daily struggle, and, you know, I can only concentrate on kind of try to stay clean and sober just one day at a time. You know, when I first got clean, it was like 1 hour at a time, and, you know, and there's been times where, you know, I've had to, you know, get back to the basics, you know, and concentrate on what's really real, you know, what's real important for me, and that is, you know, the most important thing, because I can't come in here and talk on the radio, I can't teach at PCC, I can't be a productive member of my community today unless I stay clean and sober. So being clean and sober is the most important thing, you know, to me.
There's a word that comes to my mind, and that's responsibility. And the story you're telling me about yourself, I've been a teacher many years, and I think one of the most important things that I've had to teach to all my students is responsibility. Because once one takes responsibility for anything, if it's only responsibility to walk the dog, and mom and dad said, we can't have a pet dog unless you walk the dog every day, And then when they're teenagers, to drive the car and drive it safely. You can't have a car and you can't have a license if you can't be a responsible driver. And I think that a turning point for you, maybe not the only turning point or the turning point, but something significant, was when you felt the responsibility for the lady that you had caused so much pain to by having her involved in these situations.
And we're still together today.
And you're still together today.
Absolutely.
Okay, good for you.
But, you know, you asked about the Recovery Association Project.
And yes, tell me about it.
What it did for me. So when I transitioned out of prison, I got involved with some recovery groups, and I also transitioned into an Oxford House, which helped me to be responsible.
What's an Oxford House?
Oh, there's 137, I believe, Oxford Houses in the state of Oregon, and they're clean and sober living. It's all democratically ran. They're in homes. They're in all over the city of Portland, and they're wonderful. And what that taught me was how to be accountable. Not only responsible for my addiction, but to be accountable to other people and to learn to be a productive member of society. You know, and that was something that prison doesn't teach you. They don't say, hey, this is how you balance a checkbook, and this is how you go to work every day and do this, and you got to do this. All the decisions are made for you while you're locked up and incarcerated. They tell you when you can do anything. So Oxford Houses taught me how to transition, how to become a person, you know, that got up every day and went to work, that, you know, attended house meetings, that did chores around the house, just how to be, you know, and that's what Oxford House did for me. And then when I was introduced to the Recovery Association Project, I seen that they were out trying to, like, you know, you made a statement that RAP was trying to get money at the budget hearings. Well, RAP wasn't trying to get money at the budget hearings. What we were doing there was fighting for all recovery services, for treatment beds, for house, clean and sober housing, you know, because they keep trying to take the money away from these programs that have been proven to work, you know. And so, you know, you can put people in prison, you know, all day long, right? But if you don't take care of the problem that got them there and then transition them back out into society here, then guess what? You're going to get the same person that, you know, but angrier, you know, and more victims will happen. It happened with me. So what RAP, you know, showed me when I first got involved was that I could be a voice for people in recovery. I could tell my story to help policymakers that are making decisions with our money on where they're going to spend it. If I was a part of this group to go and tell my story on how recovery worked for me, maybe they wouldn't cut funding for DePaul Treatment Center or VOA Treatment Centers or the Liddy Owen Center. So that's what, you know, what RAP does partly is we go out and we advocate, well, not advocate, but we go out and we, you know, tell people what works for people in recovery so that, you know, that people understand that, you know, there is hope. You know, recovery does happen. Recovery is very, very real. You know, I've seen tremendous changes in a lot of people that I work with. You know, and that's the other thing that we do at RAP is we provide an atmosphere for coaching and for people to network with each other to learn how to stay clean and sober one day at a time.
Well, getting back to this, the money that the Multnomah County budget, it's not just Multnomah County. It's the state. It's every state. It's the federal budget. It's the city budgets. I don't think anything is single issue. And if we can't do something about alcoholism and drug addiction, we're not ever going to be able to do anything about spousal abuse and sexual assault.
Absolutely.
We're not going to do anything about homelessness. We're not going to do anything about unemployment. Everything leans on the other thing. And the statement I had to make at the Multnomah County hearing was, instead of having us get up there and each tell our story about which health, welfare, or education program needed the most money, what we should be looking at is getting more money towards those services and less money towards things like building prisons and things like to the war on terror and things like a task force and a military force that is going to guard the borders so that immigrants come in and a task force that keeps our streets safe by arresting more people to put them in prison to make the prison population. You know, it's such a vicious cycle. What we need to do is to establish a set of values of where our money goes. And it is our money. It's our tax money. It's our federal money. And if anything, all of the programs in health, welfare, and education should be enhanced. None of them should be cut. Because when you cut one, you hurt the others. And I find that very disturbing. And And I thought those hearings were great. Night before last, or was it last night? Night before last, I think, they had hundreds of people marching around the block for the Sun School cause. Other nights, they had people from the senior citizens and disabled and so on. And all of those people, you know, senior citizens have drug and alcohol problems. They have spousal abuse problems. They have sexual assault problems. They have educational problems. They have health care problems, and on it goes.
So I got something I can tell you about your listeners that they probably don't know about what's going on in our prison system.
Okay, one sentence about that, and then tell people how to get in touch with RAP if they want to make a donation or support it.
Okay, the one sentence that a lot of people don't understand what's going on in our prison system in the state of Oregon is that they medicate people they put them on psychiatric medication. That's their cause for any kind of disruptive behavior or any kind of, if they see a person, that's their catch-all. Let's put them on some psych meds. That'll calm them down.
I'm afraid I know that, but I'm glad that you reminded us of that. And what can someone do to get in touch with RAP?
Well, you could actually get in touch with us at the Recovery Association Project by going to www.rap_nw.org, or you could call the RAP office at 503-493-9211. We're also located at 1100 Northeast 28th Avenue.
And that's near that big U-Store place there by the highway and 28th Street.
Right, 28th
Street. Kind of behind Fred Meyer.
Right.
That's right. Wonderful facility. I went to the grand opening. It was just great. You had great people there. I'd like to hear from our listeners. I hope you enjoyed listening to Rick. If you have other questions or things you'd like to know, get in touch with us. And next week, Reggae Bob will be here doing Prison Pipeline. I'm not sure what he has on his agenda, but you know he always speaks to you folks, and you're always glad to hear him. And 2 weeks from tonight, I'm going to be presenting a segment of the Prison Report that Amy Goodman presented, and aside from that, we'll also probably have some other guests, and as always, we'll always have some good music. And Rick, thank you. You have not only opened your heart and shared with us, you have given some insights that are very profound, very strong. You don't just sit there and rattle and chatter like maybe I do sometimes, but you give us some real information, and I hope that our listeners enjoy that. And I think we'll be saying good night and thank you. And
thank you.
Good to hear from you.
It's 7 o'clock and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
You better not frown. If you do, the boogeyman will get you down.
It's a boogeyman boogie. Got you on the run. It's a boogeyman boogie, gonna stop your fun.